Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, November 9th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. Thanks for tuning in. On today's show, UAS Professor Dr. Dan Monteith will preview his Friday evening at Egan lecture focusing on institutional racism, cultural trauma, and healing in Douglas. Todd Hunt will highlight this weekend's concert by the Amalga Chamber Orchestra. We'll talk about next week's presentation by the Juno Audubon Society. And Nancy DeCherney will preview the weekend's arts and entertainment opportunities with Arts Up. Those interviews, National Native News Writers Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon. Currently 37 degrees with clear skies here in Juno.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of a First Nation in Manitoba have returned to their homes on a reserve after years away. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the reserve at Lake St. Martin was ravaged in 2011.
The return home is being described as a trickle. Dozens of families have been coming home after the houses in their community were destroyed by heavy spring floods more than 6 years ago. The reserve housed 1,400 people. During the past 6 years, many stayed in hotels or in short-term rental units in the city of Winnipeg and other communities. The cost of their temporary housing reached more than $160 million. Now many have the keys to their new homes and celebrated their return. But some of the celebrations are muted because of the human cost of the displacement. More than 100 band members have died over the past few years, some from suicide. And some, like band member and university researcher Merle Ballard, are still looking for answers, such as why it took 6 years to rebuild the community.
This is the 21st century, and, you know, this is still happening. People are being displaced. They're being sacrificed for the non-Indigenous people.
The first phase of the recent rebuilding of 190 new homes will be completed by the end of January, and the government says it's committed to completing the work to get all those who were displaced home. Meanwhile, Lake St. Martin is still waiting for part of a $90 million settlement they and other First Nations filed against the federal and provincial governments. They claim that the province of Manitoba caused the flooding knowingly and recklessly by pushing excessive amounts of floodwater into Lake Manitoba. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An Indian Health Service representative says the agency is working to address issues at the Pine Ridge Hospital in South Dakota, which will lose its Medicaid funding this month. Elizabeth Fowler with IHS told the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs Wednesday, right now there are no direct actions to halt the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services from terminating its agreement. She says the IHS is considering next steps to address staffing levels and other urgent issues. The hospital received notice about the funding cut last week following a recent survey. Tribal leaders in the Great Plains region say they support proposed legislation for an assessment of health care nationwide at Indian Health Service hospitals. Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate Chairman Dave Flute told the committee tribes need to be consulted.
The accountability and transparency that we're looking for is, and it all goes back to consultation and just good communication with the tribes. Tribes are trying to help figure out what is going on in all areas. And I apologize to you, Mr. Chairman, that there is, in my opinion, there is no one that is greater than the other. It all has to do with quality of service. And we're just not getting the answers. Consultation is not there. We try to reach out and communicate, and we just don't get the answers that we're looking for.
Earlier this year, the independent outside audit of the Indian Health Service Act was introduced. Currently, there is no House companion bill. The Indian Affairs Committee Wednesday also heard testimony on the STOP Act, which would prohibit the export of sacred items and increase penalties for stealing and trafficking items. Governor Curt Riley from Acoma Pueblo told the committee tribal people are the knowledge keepers who know the difference between art and sacred items.
Who is the cultural expert here? Whenever you ask that, it is the individual Pueblos, tribes, and nations who are experts of their own culture rather than someone else who has studied our culture. They are not experts.
The Pueblo has been working with various governments to get a sacred item returned home from overseas. Riley says having the backing of federal law would help tribes in their repatriation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support provided by Freedom Lodge. Is historical trauma a concern in your community? You can join our Historical Trauma Master Class beginning February 2018. Registration deadline is December 1 at freedomlodge.org. Support by Drumbeat Indian Arts, offering authentic Native American recordings and religious herbs, crafts, supplies, books, and a wide selection of Pendleton blankets. Holiday delivery on orders placed at drumbeatindianarts.com by December 15th.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Thursday, November 9th, 2017, about 6 minutes past the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host today. In the studio with me now is UAS Professor of Anthropology, Dr. Dan Monteith, and we're going to preview his Friday Evening at Egan lecture. Welcome to the show, Dr. Monteith. Nice to have you here.
Good afternoon, Scott.
Dan, tell us a little bit about how long you've been teaching out at the university.
Yeah, I taught a full-time year down in Ketchikan in 99. I actually started in 93, UAS Southeast Ketchikan, and then been here in Juneau for 18 years.
And what are some of the classes you teach? Wow, yeah, 18.
Well, I primarily teach anthropology and archaeology courses, although I do help out with some of the different social science and other courses. So.
And what are a few of your favorite titles to teach?
You know, economic anthropology. I was just listening to that thing on Bitcoin for all the big NPR fans. That was kind of exciting. Anthropology, religion, and then a variety of different kind of what I call ethno-history courses, which really bring in the history of the local area and the region.
And speaking of that, what remind us the title of your lecture on Friday night?
Yeah, this one I worked hard, and I'll explain in my intro tomorrow night, but it's called History and Healing, A Story of Douglas.
Okay.
Yeah, and I call it a story of Douglas because kind of the tone of the talk tomorrow is I'm not getting up there as this authority of history in Douglas. I'm assuming that there's going to be some folks who have lived in Douglas and Juneau a lot longer than I have, and this is going to be looking at some more recent historical events. So I just call it a story. I'm trying to be humble in the sense that I really want to have a dialogue about the history.
Okay, and you live there too, right? So you have that connection.
Yeah. I lived on my sailboat here for the first couple of years out in Ock Bay, and then I ended up buying a little house there. The 717 St. Anne's was its old address, known as the Post House. Mrs. Post, who actually is woven into some of the story that we'll be talking about, she was the secretary for the city council, Douglas City Council. And so it was kind of interesting as I was working on this history, living in the house of one of the people who was involved with it all.
You know, beyond it's your job and that you live in Douglas, you seem very passionate about the history of Douglas and moving forward with healing. What is it about it that is so interesting to you, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I got involved with this whole story, and where I begin the story is June 2012, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners may remember as I kind of talk about that headlines of the newspaper one morning in June was that human remains had been found as they were doing renovation work on Gastineau Elementary, and there were different things where I kind of started becoming involved with that whole thing. And by September of that year, Rob Steedle from CBJ gave me a phone call and said, Douglas Indian Association and CBJ would like you to work with us on trying to figure out how could the Gastineau Elementary School, how could it have been built over Native graves or cemetery, and to try and understand that, you know. And so that's kind of where I originally came on board, and that's like 5 years ago now. And I've looked through thousands of pages of in digital form, which is eye-numbing, looking at Douglas City Council minutes, thousands of pages of newspapers to try and look and understand the feelings of the day and legally and otherwise what went on. And one of the confounding things there are things that make it really, you have to be a history detective, so to speak, is in 1937 there was one of the three or four fires, I call it four fires now, and that will be where I end my talk. But in 1937, there was the fire in Douglas that burnt down the city hall. So we lost all the most of the birth certificates, death certificates, legal deeds, and so many of the legal records that would tell probably a lot of this story, you know, where folks were buried, when they were buried, who was buried there, so many different things. Even the legal deeds to some of the lands, you know, that are in question. So, it's been a real interesting odyssey of looking through so many different records.
And who are some of the Thlinget culture bearers you've been speaking to and helping to understand this?
Yeah, I've been really blessed to work closely with Douglas Indian Association. And I talked to them that first fall, and I said, who would you recommend? And it was really working with the Douglas Indian Association and other Native entities. And they developed a list of what I'd call key consultants, you know, elders and people who grew up in Juneau and Douglas and who went to the schools over there and who lived over there, and several of them. And, you know, this fall we've lost two of them, Bill Fawcett and Nora Dauenhauer. John Morrison has been a huge provider of information living over there. Paul Marks, Helen Sarabia, who passed away a few years ago. So we're losing some of those elders who were a part of this project. That's one of the dangers if they go on a long time, you know. But the fortunate thing was we were able to, you know, get interviews and record some of that history.
Okay. So you did mention that you're going to outline some of the history, as you've done here, but you really want to focus on healing.
Yeah. One of the things I want to talk about, being kind of a cultural anthropologist, but even more so an educator that's lived in the community, how can we talk about the building of the school over, or the, yeah, building of the school over these graves? And then an event that happens a couple years later that's really related, the burning of several homes and Native structures right there in Douglas. You know, they both are indicative of a mood and kind of an attitude at that time and place, in particular by the Douglas City Council, that is really, to me, representative of institutional racism. You know, and so those are hard topics. You know, how do we move ahead as a community and really kind of reverse those negative attitudes and feelings? And how do we move ahead in kindness and love for our neighbors and begin healing? And there's the two poles, one that's gone up already and one that will go up, I believe, this coming summer, that kind of represent that healing. But it's going to be an ongoing process for educators and the community.
If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Dr. Dan Monteith. He'll be speaking tomorrow as part of the UAS Evening at Egan Lecture Series, 7 p.m., right?
7 p.m., and we'll live stream it also, so don't risk life and limb if we do get those 6 inches of snow. But do come out. We're going to actually have, I hope, a little something to give all the guests who come there. And the other thing is really, hopefully at the end, we can have a bit of a dialogue and discussion And I hope a lot of educators and students and just any person from the community comes.
And I saw a preview of this at the Power and Privilege and Symposium, Power and Privilege Symposium, on Tuesday. And you had some photos that you were sharing.
Yeah, I probably have, I've got 80 to 90 slides and many historical slides. So, that'll be kind of an interesting backdrop and always visually, I think, entertaining to look at all these photos that really show how much that area has changed over the years.
Okay. Are you in the library or the lecture hall?
We're in the Egan Lecture Hall. So it's going to be Egan 112, the good old lecture hall, 7 p.m. And come if you can.
Tomorrow, Friday at UAS and free, as always.
You bet.
Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show and thanks for doing what you do. Anything else you'd like to share about tomorrow?
No, just thank you so much for letting me talk about this. And I think it's going to be an ongoing discussion in our community. Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 9th of November, 2017. It's the birthday of the astronomer Carl Sagan, Brooklyn, 1934, popular guest on TV shows, including The Tonight Show, talking about the cosmos. He was also a consultant to NASA on several of their unmanned missions, and he was host of a very popular show on PBS, Cosmos, aired in 1980. It's the birthday of Anne Sexton, the poet, born Newton, Massachusetts, 1928. Anne Sexton, who said, "Live or die, make up your mind. If you're going to hang around, don't ruin everything. Don't poison the world." She grew up with an alcoholic father, a rather cold mother. Her great aunt, whom she adored, went mad, died in a nursing home. Sexton suffered from bipolar disorder, was sent away to boarding school. She said the only thing she learned there was how to make a white sauce. She tried modeling, and then at the age of 19, she married. She had two children. She said, "All I wanted was to be married, to have children. I was trying to lead a conventional life." She started therapy. Her doctor suggested that she try writing. She went to poetry workshops. She met Sylvia Plath, and they became great friends. She became friends with the poet Maxine Cumin. They went to poetry readings together. Her first book came out in 1960, To Bedlam and Partway Back. Anne Sexton, who said, "Writers are such phonies. They sometimes have wise insights, but they don't live by them at all. That's what writers are like. You think they know something, but usually they are just messes." Anne Sexton, who died by suicide 1974, wrapped herself in her mother's fur coat and climbed into her car and sat in it while it was running. And it's the birthday of Ivan Turgenev, born in Oryol, Russia, 1818. Parents were nobility, had a huge estate, 5,000 serfs. Turgenev loved hunting in the woods, and the book that made him famous was called A Sportsman's Sketches, a collection of stories in which the narrator travels around his estate hunting, but it's not about hunting. It's about the serfs who lived there and how they were abused at the hands of landowners. 9 years after Turgenev's book came out, serfdom was abolished in Russia. Here's a poem by Anne Sexton, "The Truth the Dead Know," dedicated to her mother and her father. "Gone, I say, and walk from church, refusing the stiff procession to the grave, letting the dead ride alone in the hearse. It is June. I'm tired of being brave. We drive to the Cape. I cultivate myself where the sun gutters from the sky, where the sea swings in like an iron gate. And we touch. In another country, people die. My darling, the wind falls in like stones from the white-hearted water. And when we touch, we enter touch entirely. No one's alone. men kill for this, or for as much. And what of the dead? They lie without shoes in their stone boats. They're more like stone than the sea would be if it stopped. They refuse to be blessed. Throat, eye, and knuckle bone. A poem by Anne Sexton, The Truth the Dead Know, from her Complete Poems, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Staples, with copy and print solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets, signage, and more. In stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, November 9th, 21 minutes after the hour. In the studio now is William Todd Hunt, and we're going to be talking about Southeast and Beyond.
And Beyond, yeah, Scott, looking forward to it.
I feel like we need some reverb there. Beyond.
Beyond, yeah.
This Saturday and Sunday, two shows on Sunday.
No, just one show.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, so it's Saturday, 8 o'clock,
okay.
And Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Northern Light United Church.
That's right.
Southeast and Beyond. Tell us how it
came
to be.
Yeah, sure. So I was looking to do a concert with the Amalgamated Chamber Orchestra that would feature the first music we're going to hear from our opera commission based on the sinking of the Princess Sophia that we've had going on for the last few years. And so we'll be premiering 25 minutes or so of that opera on this concert. And I thought, well, it'd be nice to sort of try to pull together a lot of local sort of ideas to play on the concert as well. So Artemio Sandoval, who is a local composer / bassoonist, who you've certainly seen playing in opera pits and on the symphony stage and that kind of thing, he also is actually a very talented composer who is very young, and so I think it's exciting to kind of get him when he's young and get him writing stuff for us. So anyway, he had this piece for wind ensemble called Fortress of the Bears, and I asked him if he would do an orchestral transcription of that. And he did way more than that. He took the piece and sort of completely reworked it, where I thought he was just going to add a few string parts. But he went all out and added a few sections, changed around some transitions, and did all sorts of things. So it's really a brand new piece that so it'll be a world premiere there.
Excellent. Fortress of the Bears.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have Princess Sophia.
Right.
Fortress of the Bears, and then uh-huh. Where do we go?
So, and then we go to Vega. So, yes, yeah, Southeast and Beyond.
We stopped in Seattle.
Oh, yeah, we stopped in Seattle first. So, Alan Hovhaness, who is formerly of Seattle because he died in 2000, but he lived in Seattle for 30-some years and was a wildly prolific composer, wrote 60-some symphonies. You know, you think of like Beethoven, who wrote 9, and Mahler, who wrote 9, and everybody just wrote 9. This guy wrote 60 some odd. And so we're doing his number 52, which could be a world premiere. I'll tell you a little bit about this in a second. It's definitely, I think, a U.S. premiere, though. When I was looking for the music to get this, I've talked to the publisher, and they had no record of it ever being performed. Now, this was written in 82-83, so it had been, quite a while, and I guess records could be lost and whatnot. But so it's a premiere of some sort.
The 80s, when people were looking outward,
right? Yeah,
to
totally.
The universe for inspiration.
Totally, yeah. So the music of Hovhaness is actually really interesting and very different. It's meditative and mostly calm, with occasional bumps of drama in there as well. But you can kind of think it's like you're settling in your spaceship on a long ride to Vega, and this is what you're listening to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Remind us how many people are actually in this orchestra.
Okay, so yeah, so the 30, the biggest piece is Artemio's, and it has 38 people in there. So it's, there's the, I think we said the concert's at Northern Light Church, and we will be packing them in there. So it's, I went and sort of pushed around chairs and such today, and it will fit, but just barely. But it'll be actually a really nice space to do that in. So that's the largest in it. The smallest is at the symphony, oddly enough, and that's probably 25 people in there. So, and this is a good size group.
And a host of singers.
Yes, yeah, we've got 7 singers that will be helping us premiere the Emerson Eads and Dave Hunsaker opera, Princess Sophia, the excerpts from that. So we've got Tess Altaveros, who is from Seattle, and Kathleen Wayne from Juneau, Wendy Burns from Juneau, actually everybody else is from Juneau, Jay Query, Mark Calvert, Zebediah Bodine, and Wade Rogers.
Wow, exciting, yeah. Exciting. You know, it seems like it's common in the folk music mm-hmm. genre for people to compose their own songs. What is this like in the sort of the classical canon?
Yeah, so it's, you know, right, and that's an interesting thing because we've been talking a little bit about folk music and composing and whatnot lately. It's, in the classical world, it's a really big deal if you're a composer, where I think in the folk era, that sort of genre, that you're sort of expected to at least do a few of your own. Otherwise, who are you? What are you doing here? I think it just kind of goes back to how we're trained, and we are trained to perform music. We take a printed page and do it the best we can, and then we have these people who specialize in composing, and maybe they're performers, maybe they're not. Actually, a lot of times they're not. So they give as much detailed instruction to the specialist performers who play this. So
this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
This is very cool.
I think it's a huge deal, and it's not every day. I mean, opera is still an art form that's alive, and people are still writing. Actually, the Met just had a one of their, frankly, too few world premieres. The Exterminating Angel is a new opera they just did, and a world premiere there. But it doesn't happen as often as I think it should. So we've, I guess, gotten in the habit, since this is our second opera commission, to try to do this on a regular basis.
Okay, so people should get tickets where?
So tickets are available at all the Vendini locations, like the Jack and Hearthside Books. At the door, they'll be available as well if there's any left.
And 3 showings again, right?
2 showings.
2 showings. Sorry, 2 showings. I keep getting it right.
No, that's right. We can talk about the yeah. shows. So it's this Saturday at 8 o'clock and this Sunday at 3 o'clock at Northern Light Church.
Got it. Same show both days?
Yes.
I mean,
oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It will be, yeah, it's the same. we'll strive to make it as much the same as possible. Well, you can also get tickets through our website as well if you'd rather do that kind of thing, at orpheusproject.org, or it's also available at the Jack website, jahc.org.
Would you guess about a 2-hour program?
Yeah, it's about a 2. As far as music goes, it's under 2 hours, but, you know, with the shifting around and whatnot, it's would definitely be under 2 hours.
Beyond sort of the localness of all of this, what's it been like pulling this together?
Oh, it's actually been a joy. And so I feel like I've been living this Princess Sophia thing for the last probably year now, because we're gearing up for the full-on world premiere, which is going to be about a year from now in October. And I'm sure I'll come back and talk more about that. But we're, you know, pulling designers together for that. Of course, the composer and librettist, the person who writes the text, Dave Hunsaker, all of us getting together actually on a fairly regular basis and working out how all this is going to go. And it's like, oh, right, and we've got this concert too. So we've got lots of interesting things going on, and pulling together like Artemio's piece, for instance, too. I'm super pleased with it. It's a great contrast to the rest of the program, and so it's a really nicely well-rounded program, if I do say so.
All right, and tell us about the song. I picked it out. I was telling you about it. It's one of Alan Havanas's tunes.
Oh, right, The Mysterious Mountain. Yeah. It's one of his early symphonies, number 2, way back when. And again, we're doing number 52. I've listened to it sort of recently. As I recall, it has a lot of the same sort of ideas, floaty string lines, sort of funny harmonic things that kind of happen there. But, you know, he was very much one with nature and all that surrounds him. He was also, you know, liked astronomy and that kind of thing. And so there's a lot of that sort of mysticism of the world around you is in his music.
So hear that and more.
Yes.
8 p.m.
8 p.m. on Saturday.
Saturday, Northern Night United Church.
Yep.
And 3 p.m. on Sunday.
You got it.
Todd, thank you so much. Anything else you want to add?
No, I just hope to see you there.
All right. Thank you.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Serving Juneau since 1978, Ron's Apothecary is providing medication information, nutritional supplements, and homeopathic remedies. More information at ronsapothecary.com.
Find out about a life so fascinating, so compelling, that it draws 1920s movie star John Barrymore to the wilderness of Glacier Bay. Who is the couple he keeps returning to visit, and how are their lives intertwined? Dreaming Glacier Bay is a new play based on true events by Juno playwright Joel Bennett. See it at Perseverance Theater, October 24th to November 18th. Tickets at ptalaska.org, The Jack, Hearthside Books, and 463-TIXS.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, November 9th, 2017, about 23 minutes until the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host today in the studio now, is Bill Heard and also Brenda Wright, and we're here to talk about the Juno Audubon Society presentation tonight at 7 p.m. out at the UAS Rec Center. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thanks.
It's nice to have you here. All right, so tonight, 7 p.m., UAS Rec Center, what room is it?
It's at room 116. Take a left when you come in the door.
And how would you describe, if somebody hasn't been to the rec center before, Brenda, how do they get there?
Well, you know, when you go around the roundabout at Auk Bay, you come up the hill and you take a right to the university. Don't do that. Go left. And there's a big building there, and that's the recreation center.
Okay. And, Bill, tell us the title of your talk tonight.
Well, thank you. My talk tonight at the Audubon meeting will be Chasing Neotropical Migrants in the Lower Rio Grande Valley.
Can you give us an example of a neotropical migrant, please?
Oh, yes. Well, neotropical migrants are the birds that go for the wintertime. They may nest here in the Juneau area or anywhere in North America. And in the late summer and fall, they tend to migrate to warmer climes. And the ones that go south of the U.S. into Mexico and Yucatan, all into Central America and into South America, and then they return in the spring. We call those neotropical birds, and there's a broad sweep of neotropical birds. A lot of the water birds are neotropical, but I'm going to be talking tonight about a special subgroup of neotropical birds called passerine birds. These are our perching birds or songbirds, and so that's why we go to the lower Rio Grande Valley to catch these birds, these neotropical migrants, as they're coming back across the Gulf of Mexico. These little tiny songbirds flying nonstop across the Gulf of Mexico. Often when they reach landfall, they're tired, hungry, and they stop. So this is a very wonderful place to go to see so many of these neotropical birds.
And what's an example that of a bird or two that maybe our listeners will recognize?
Oh, well, yes. We have some of the passerine neotropicals that we have here. We have several warblers, the Wilson warbler, the yellow warbler, the yellow rump warbler. But we also have some of the shorebirds that are neotropical. Many of them will go into the tropics and then come back north.
Okay. And what are a few examples of those that we might recognize?
Well, that would be like the yellow legs is often neotropical. Not all of the birds of a given species might go into the tropics. Some might winter in the lower along the Gulf Coast, but others would go into neotropical areas.
Okay. And you said you were down there in April, right?
In April. For the last 4 years, in fact, my wife and I, Charlotte, we have spent either most or all of the month of April in the lower Rio Grande Valley. Now, earlier in our career or life, we had done some birding on other parts of the Texas coast. And incidentally, the Texas Gulf Coast is, the whole Gulf Coast, is a great place for birding. I mean, they're just wonderful, unique birds, resident birds of the area. But for these neotropicals, April is a good month, kind of the peak period of when the neotropicals are coming back across the Gulf. And they tend to concentrate along that Gulf Coast area.
And I bet it's beautiful in April.
Well, it
it's
is.
Not it's not too hot yet, right?
No, it's not too hot. And in April, we usually go in late March and then spend the whole month of April. We have in recent months. And, you know, in late April, in late March, it's still kind of wintry here. So it's a good respite to get away.
These birds are smart. They know where to be where the good weather is, right?
The bird migration is an amazing subject. And this is just one little tiny part of it, of course. But the birds that I'll be concentrating on and talking about tonight, I mentioned, are these passerine birds. These are the colorful songbirds, the warblers, the vireos, the tanagers, and many of the other colorful birds that we have all across North America.
Okay, and were you able to take some pictures of some of these birds?
Well, I tried.
No, they're pretty small.
bird photography is a subject that I'm just really now getting into, and they're small, and some of them pretty easy. You take, for example, tanagers and grosbeaks. Buntings, they're usually pretty photo ready. They'll sit around, but the one group of birds they're really focused on are the warblers, and these are all primarily arboreal birds in the trees, but they're always chasing insects, running around. They're never still more than a microsecond, so they're very difficult and challenging to take pictures of.
That's the voice of Bill Hurd. He's going to be speaking tonight at UAS as a part of the Juno Audubon Society's presentation series, I guess. I've asked Brenda this question before, Bill. You're a lifelong bird enthusiast, you told me. What is it about birds that is so interesting to you?
Well, birds are a very important part of the whole array of animals and plants that we have. Birds sort of exemplify some of the more beautiful parts. The migration of birds, as I mentioned, is so dynamic and so interesting. And worldwide, you know, birds are becoming more of interest to many people. Birding, used to be called bird watching. And it's still, you can still bird watch, but people get really interested in it and focus on it and study the ecology and learn about them. We now use the term birding.
Got it. Besides going to the talk tonight at 7 p.m. at UAS, what are birders watching right now, Brenda?
Well, this time of year, it's really fun to see how many of our overwinter species are back. And it was fun for me to just the other day at Auk-Rec to see that both kinds of golden eyes and the harlequins and they're, you know, everybody that's going to be here all winter, they're definitely back now.
And where are they back from?
You know, most of these birds like to go someplace where freshwater to nest in the summertime. And so they come here and they have a wonderful open ocean that doesn't freeze, and there's plenty of food for them here. And so this is a nice, comfortable place to spend the winter.
Are these like neo-Arctic as compared to your neotropical? I don't know.
Yeah, that would be true. They go to the Arctic for nesting, and then they come back and spend here in the wintertime.
Okay. Well, this sounds like a lot of fun. 7 p.m. tonight at the UAS Rec Center. And which room was it again, Brenda?
It's room 116. And I just wanted to put a little short plea out there. We need a couple more volunteers for our public market booth. Juno Audubon is going to be selling their famous jam again. So if anybody's interested, please get in touch.
I found you on Facebook pretty easily. Is that a good place to find you?
Yep, sure is.
Okay. Thank you both for coming on the show today. The talk at 7 p.m. tonight. Anything else either of you would like to add?
No, but I hope you can come birding sometime with us.
All right. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. Some of the best ways to help backyard birds through the winter mean doing less, not more. First, leave the leaves. Tasty insects and spiders live underneath. Backyard birds like the towhee and the song sparrow will pick and kick through leaves again and again. Leave them where they've drifted, or rake them up under your plantings. Second, don't deadhead the plants in your garden. Birds like pine siskins and goldfinches love to snack on dead flower heads all winter long. Number 3. Build an insect hotel. Okay, there's some work involved in this one, but it's a cool project for kids and adults to do together. Make a structure out of natural objects and found items to create little hidey holes for insects. Some of these cozy hotel guests will become food for wrens and other birds. It's also a great way to repurpose old bricks and flower pots and bits of wood while creating your own sculpture. So, park the rake in the shed, and the clippers too. The birds will thank you. Support for Bird Note comes from Songbird Coffee, offering bird-friendly, organic, shade-grown coffee for holiday giving. More at birdnote.org/songbird.
The Hub After School program invites you to a dinner and auction on Saturday, November 11th, starting at 6 p.m. at the Hub. The Hub After School program provides an opportunity for middle school kids to study, learn, and socialize in a safe and supervised environment during the hours between the end of school and early evening at no cost to them. Join the fun and help support a free, important program for Juno youth. The Hub is located at 8001 Glacier Highway across from Fred Meyer. Tickets are $20 and available at the Hub or at the door. Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement. Available at locations throughout Southeast. More at seakliving.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, November 9th, about 12 minutes till the top of the hour. In the studio now is Nancy DeCherney, the Executive Director of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, here to give us our weekly rundown of arts and entertainment opportunities for this weekend.
Run be the key word here. We've got to move fast. Okay.
Got some stuff for us.
So we have this evening at 7:30, and then through the weekend we have Dreaming Glacier Bay. And you said you're going to be doing a talk back with them on Sunday?
That's right. I get to speak with Joel Bennett and talk a little bit more about the play after the show. It starts at 3, right? No, four.
It's a great play, and I've seen it, and I really highly recommend it. It's intriguing and entertaining and funny, everything. We have a ballroom dance over at the Jack from 7 to 10 p.m. This is one of the Juno Ballroom Dance folks. They're doing cha-cha lessons with Lorinda Kasner. The Power and Privilege thing is happening on Friday out at the University in Eagan. I think you've had folks on about talk about that. There's the Sons of Norway Holiday Bazaar. It's the bizarre time of year.
Indeed.
Starting Saturday morning at 9, and then there's an arts and crafts fair out at Mendenhall Mall at 10. The ski sale, the ever-popular ski sale, and looking at the weather report, we'll be all ready for that.
Yeah, exciting.
Yeah, 10 o'clock Saturday morning, Centennial Hall. You queue up real early or get your tent out or something. There's a Nightlight International and Landmine Design Jewelry Party at the Calvary House. This is a jewelry sale where proceeds support women rescued from sex trade and their vocational training and flight. So there's a second Saturday market at the Airport Mall from 10 to 3. The Story of Ferdinand the Bull. This is an ever perennial favorite, and Linda Rosenthal is performing it with Brett Dillingham. It's out at the Mendenhall Public Library, so that means it's free, 1 to 2. There's adult pickleball at Murray Drake Gym. There's Friends of the Library annual meeting. There's a stylorama, which is like a cool fashion show at the Red Dog Saloon. Going down for that. That's on Saturday at 4 till 8. There is the Amalga Chamber Orchestra Southeast and Beyond. This is at Northern Light Church. This is sort of the prelude to the Princess Sophia Opera. It's performed Saturday night at 8 and then again on Sunday at 3 p.m.
And we had Todd Hunt give us details about that today, too. So
and this is also written locally, too. So mm-hmm. This is very exciting. All these crafty people, arty people here in town. Cocoa and Kindness at the Diamond Park Field House, the JPD. We'd like to invite everybody come have hot chocolate. On Sunday from 1 to 4, there is a Thanksgiving for the many gifts of the LGBTQ and community at Aldersgate from 4 to 6. On Tuesday, we want everybody to come out dancing. We've got the hottest band coming. It is wonderful. Latin rhythms and rock and roll and all sorts of stuff. La Santa Cecilia, they are a Grammy Award winning group. They've just been in Ketchikan, so if you know anybody in Ketchikan, you can check in with them. They're headed to Anchorage. They are on this whirlwind tour. After they're here, they go to Cordova. But this group is really happy, fun music, and it's going to be a great dance and opportunity.
That's part of the Jack's season, right?
Mm-hmm. It is, and we're very excited about them, actually. 5 to 8 p.m., like, why wouldn't we be? We wouldn't have brought them otherwise.
Yeah. And it seems so great to have Latin music in the cold of winter.
Oh, yeah.
Just get
hot,
Tuesday night and
dance
practice all those salsa moves.
Yeah, that
we've
just learned.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting. 5 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, there's holiday wreath making at Nugget Mall. There's David Riccio's got a class going at 5:30 at the Canvas. There's a ukulele lullaby thing going on. At 7 p.m. on Tuesday, it's Mudrooms over at Northern Lights with real people, real stories. I don't remember what the theme is this week, but they always have a wonderful performance. But, of course, unfortunately, it conflicts with this dance party. I don't know what to do. I know where I'll be. On Wednesday, there's a food security and composting in Juneau thing happening at the Assembly Chambers. And there's Altered Books. Learn to cut, fold, paste, and glue and make things out of old books. Chasing Coral at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, and again the Chase Dreaming Glacier Bay. So you got yourself a pretty busy week, and it's building up to Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. So Nancy, you just said so many things. I can't remember all of them. Where could I possibly go to find this wonderful list that you and all of your colleagues across the street put together for us every week?
It is at jahc.org, and it is at ktoo.org. So if you did need the details on something, check it out. And if you want something on the calendar, give us a call.
And this is no small feat for all of you putting this together, is it?
Melanie spends a great deal of her time putting all this together. You know, when you bring your posters in to get hung up, which we offer that service, all of those get entered on here. When you bring your tickets in and you get your tickets into our ticketing system, those get put here. And then people just send us emails and such. There is a place online to email this information in. So it's a nice way. We try to make it so everybody in the community can look in one spot and see what's going on.
Well, it's a great service. Thanks to you and everyone over there who does that. Nancy DeCherney, Arts Up here on November 9th, 2017. Anything else you want to add?
See you on the dance floor
all
Tuesday.
Right.
this is Sue Douglas. Are you interested in inspiring and informing future generations? A gift through your will or other estate planning to the KTOO Legacy Foundation is a wonderful way to ensure the future of public media. Find out more at ktoo.org/legacy or call the station at 586-1670. KTOO's Legacy Foundation, ensuring the future of public media in Juneau.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon today. Tomorrow, during Veterans Day, we will not have a Juneau Afternoon, but a special called Intelligence Squared Debate, Why We Should Pay College Athletes. Or if we should pay college athletes, we'll play in the Juneau Afternoon time slot. Let's take a look at the weather. Tonight calls for a 20% chance of snow after 3 a.m., Friday, snow, high near 35, and we do have a weather advisory for tomorrow, which reads, heavy snow, total snow accumulations of 6 to 9 inches are expected in Juneau and Northern Admiralty Island, and it's going to begin Friday morning with greater snowfall rates midday through late afternoon, and significant reductions in visibility are possible, and transportation could also be affected. So heads up for that. And then looking towards Saturday, a 30% chance of snow before 3 a.m. and Sunday mostly cloudy with the high near 31. Thanks for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon.